Hey folks, welcome back to the High Performance Human Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Ward, founder of thetriathloncoach.com, High Performance Human, and SWOT Inner Circle. And I am on a mission to help you upgrade your human performance. I truly believe that we all have the potential to perform better as humans through improved sleep, nutrition, fitness, mobility, and stress management. And in doing so, live longer, live healthier, and of course, improve your athletic performance. If you're interested in joining me on this journey, please check out my SWOT Inner Circle, where you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. Please just email Beth at thetriathloncoach.com or look for the link in the show notes. Now, on to today's podcast, the subject of which is something we very rarely talk about in triathlon, saddles. And my guest is Daniel Sharder, an expert in helping riders find the perfect seat for their ride. Daniel's the CEO of German company Gebiermeist, and whilst it's unlikely that you'll ever have heard of them, you will know some of the riders they've worked with, including Jan Frodeno, Sebastian Keenley, Alistair Brownlee, and Annie Haug, to name a few. To be quite frank, I was staggered about how underrated the importance of the saddle is. For example, if you think about your own situation, when you consider upgrades for your bike to improve performance, where would the saddle be in your list of priorities, if it's in that list at all? It was a really eye-opening chat for me, and I'm sure it will be for you too. During the conversation, Daniel explains how the company was formed and the unique pressure mapping system that they use to enable him to create the most comfortable saddle and fit for each rider. And we also talk about the health and performance impacts of poor saddle fit, how stability and comfort on the saddle has a direct relationship to your aerodynamics, the difference between triathlon and road bike saddles, why your first equipment upgrade should be the saddle, the secret saddle club that was formed out of a meeting with British Cycling, the importance of understanding how you load your saddle, and finally, the three biggest saddle errors committed by triathletes and why you're probably guilty of at least two of them. Alright, so enough of the chit-chat, let's crack on with today's guest. So, welcome to the show, Daniel. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, hello, Simon. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, you're in Munster in Germany now. So, that's my German geography is not particularly good, but I think most people will have heard of Dortmund, which is the biggest city near to you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. So when you think about Germany, it's the northwest of Germany, and you have to drive about an hour from Dortmund to the north, and then you should arrive in Münster.
Okay.
It's, by the way, called the capital city in terms of bicycles. So I think you don't have another city in Germany which has the same rate of bicycles per citizen. So that's maybe also part of our whole story.
Is it quite flat there then? Is that why there's a lot of riding? Is it sort of like a similar sort of culture to the Netherlands and Belgium?
Yeah, that's true. So we don't have a lot of hills over here, and we don't have any mountains. So it's really, we have a saying here that wind is our biggest enemy. So wind is our mountain. I think that tells a lot. It's really flat, and we have a lot of road cyclists riding here, and they really enjoy that. But we don't have a strong MTB scene.
So would you be close to the French border or the Belgian border then, or Luxembourg maybe?
It's the Netherlands is the closest border.
Okay.
So we have to drive to the south to come to Belgium. That's more around the region of Aachen and Cologne. Yeah. So, for example, Enschede is the next Dutch city, which is just about 50K away. So that's really close to the Dutch border.
Okay, well, thank you for the geography lesson. That's not why we're chatting, of course, today, because I wanted to chat about your company and the work you do around saddles and saddle fit for cyclists and triathletes. So your business is called Gebiermeist, which I sat and looked at that word for ages and thought, well, how have they come by this name? So maybe we can start there in how the company began and maybe your background as well with saddles and bikes.
Yeah, so maybe we start really with the name of the company. So we have a mother company, which is called GBIOM, which is a short phrase for Society of Biomechanics Münster. And they have founded themselves in 1994, so pretty long time ago. And they do a lot in sports science. They do a lot in medical technology. They are really experts in pressure mapping for all kind of applications. So just not just bicycles or sports, but also medical applications, just like gait analysis and other kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then in the beginning, I think it was 2001, when we got a first request if we can develop a pressure mapping tool for saddles especially. So we build up these systems on our own, all these pressure mats that we're building, that's something we produce in-house in Münster. So it was possible for us to translate all the information or the systems we had from other applications into a bicycle saddle design. So we made a sensor mat that has the layout of a bicycle saddle that you can put on a saddle. Mm-hmm. It includes a lot of sensors, and then we can measure the pressure distribution between the rider and the saddle. And we made some studies and found, okay, this might be a really interesting case to dig deeper and to maybe build up a company about that. And then we searched for a name. It was in 2005. And at the end, we came up with that phrase, Gbiomized, which combines the mother company name Gbiom and customized. Ah. So the end of customized. So we say it's not customized when, for example, you work with us or you get a product from us. It's not a customized product. It's a Gbiomized product. Ah. To be honest, nobody understood it at that time. We spoke with a lot of German cyclists and also German dealers, and they all said, we don't understand the reason. Then we thought, okay, if we go international and speak with English people, it might be easier, but it was the same way. So nobody understood, but now it's just too late because everybody or a lot of people have heard about us and know what we're doing. And I think it's just nice. It's always the intro to explain our name.
So that must be quite difficult. I mean, it's always difficult to get a new company off the ground, but when you're trying to introduce a product that's nobody's familiar with, it's like pushing a big snowball up a hill, isn't it? It's a big struggle for quite a long time until you get some momentum.
Yeah, especially in the starting phase. So I remember these first bicycle fairs, exhibitions where there Eurobike, for example, in 2005, and we spoke to some first dealers about the idea, about the concept, and everybody was really hesitating, okay, and really questioning what we are doing. You have got a laptop over here, you have got this fancy technology, and you explain me that I have to decide the best saddle for my client next year by using this kind of technology that doesn't work. I have sold 100 years saddles in a specific way. I don't need a technology approach to that. Yeah. And I really remember these first discussions, and this was really, it was a hard time to start and to really get a little bit of momentum. And then we changed from just concentrating only on the saddle to looking at all the contact points and looking at the overall position. And I think this was a game changer for us because it was quite a short way from saddle fit only to the whole bike fitting and cycling analysis and positioning stuff. Mm-hmm. And this really opened up our market, and this helped us to be still here, because that means at the end it was a little bit of success. Otherwise you wouldn't go 15 years of that history with the company.
Well, and I guess things like Retool were gaining popularity around that time. So that was bike fit. So the fact that bike fitting was more in people's vision would have helped you as well, because you'd have been carried along with that and that whole wave.
Yeah, so the whole bike fitting topic really helped us also to gain some traction. But you have to keep in mind, we have done it in a complete different way, at least in the beginning. So at that time, everybody talked bike fitting like we have to analyze angles and we have to bring a person and some angles into a specific range. And we have talked about, okay, we have to look at the contact points, we have to create more comfort on the saddle, we have to increase contact area, reduce saddle sores, and the same with pedals, for example. We have an in-shoe pressure mapping system to say we want to optimize the pedal stroke, we want to increase efficiency and all of that kind of stuff. But we also always said angles are just a second additional information for us. So angles are nice, but just for the ballpark. Fine tuning is about pressure mapping. And we were the only company at that point of time to really promote that approach. I'm super happy that it's now different. A lot of bike fitters out there believe in pressure mapping, look at numbers, and really help to increase comfort. But the beginning was really how to bring an angle-driven approach and a pressure-driven approach together.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you think about it logically, you know, there are only three points of contact on the bike, aren't there? You've mentioned two, the pedals and the saddle and obviously the bars. And the rest of it is just support and framework for that and creating momentum. It surprises me that nobody really thought much more about the saddle other than, you know, we need this shape. Because I can remember picking up my first bike when I was 8 or 9 and thinking, wow, that looks like a razor blade. How am I ever going to be comfortable on there? And the basic shape and design of the saddle hasn't really changed a lot. And, you know, when I got my first bike was you know, 50 years ago. And saddles have been similar to that going back 50 years before that as well.
Yeah, that's true. So, I was asking the same question to myself for quite a long time. So why we are so specific in emphasizing the importance of a saddle so much, and why is not the rest of the industry following? We have talked with a lot of industry partners 10 years ago, and there were just a few thinking, okay, it might be worth to really think about a saddle design from a biomechanical or from an objective study standpoint to really make sure, okay, we have analyzed a lot of people, we know how they load the saddle, and then we can build up a saddle that works for them. This was always our approach to do it, because we're coming from the university, we have that background of being more scientific in our approach, and for us it was pretty clear, if we want to make a product, we have to understand how the product is needed, what's on the market in terms of saddle load, and how to make it better. And we all have to keep in mind the saddle is so important because it carries a significant part of the body weight. It carries way more than the bars, hopefully. And it normally, if you're not riding in your intervals, for example, with a super high wattage, it also carries more body weight than your pedals. And you have a small contact area because the pelvis itself is not super large, and you don't sit like on a chair with a very large contact area. You have a small contact area. So the best way to make a saddle is to get the most out of that contact area and to make it as effective as possible, that you can bring your body weight to that saddle and get support in the best case from both sides, but also a good balance between the front and the back, because there are also some things that you have to keep in mind if you want to make a saddle.
Anybody that's listening to this that's ridden long distances or ridden on consecutive days on a trip, Land's End to John O'Groats or a multi-day trip has probably experienced some sort of saddle soreness and irritation and, you know, inflammation. If you've got sore perineum, and that can lead to all sorts of other complications when you're urinating and, you know, with reproduction. Like you say, the complications if your saddle is badly fitted or the right or the wrong type for you are exponential, aren't they? And if we go back to just the discomfort, if you've ever had a saddle sore and then having to sit on a saddle for another few hours, then that's all you think about. You don't think about the riding. All you can think about is wiggling around to try and find the most comfortable position. Now, if you're in a race, that's critical, because you're not going to be concentrating on riding. Your power output's going to drop, and that's going to affect your overall performance. So, again, seems obvious now we talk about it, but clearly it wasn't that obvious to people for a while, and it was almost like a badge of honor to have a saddle sore and ride through it.
Yeah, so exactly like you say, when you're not stable and comfortable on the saddle, there are a lot of possibilities to compensate for that. And all of these compensation movements are bad for your performance and for your overall comfort. For example, if you feel that the saddle on one side is just creates a hot spot and it has too much pressure and you want to get rid of it, you normally shift to the other side. That can influence your knee pedaling. It can mean that your knee, for example, now travels also to the inside or kicks to the outside. This is, of course, a negative effect to the knee movement itself, but it also has a negative effect to your performance and to your power, because then you create more shear forces. You're not standing straight on the pedal. You lose some power just by having a different vector of the power or of the force into the pedal. So you have some losses. And even when you just have maybe 1% of loss, you have every single pedal stroke. You do that 90 times per minute, and you have that in a race more maybe for 4 hours or 5 hours or whatever. And there's, if you all count these one percenters, it's a lot that you lose over such a race just by having maybe the wrong saddle. And one thing to mention in that regard is saddle model is one case, but the other case is also the saddle fit, so the whole saddle position. And when I talk about saddle position, I mean saddle height, saddle fore aft, and also saddle tilt. These three, for me, are a package of the saddle position. And this saddle fit is also, I would say, as important as the right saddle model. You can bring the best saddle for you in the wrong position, and then you don't feel comfortable, or the other way around as well. You can have a saddle which is maybe not optimal for you, but by having the right fit, it might be just better than the last ride. So always think about that as a package, saddle model plus the saddle positioning.
Well, we'll come back to saddle tilt at the end, if I may, because that's something I notice a lot as a triathlon coach. And I mean, interesting what you say there about the way in which the way you sit on the saddle and how that impacts your biomechanics and different tightnesses and pressures and ability to generate power. If you're a cyclist, you finish your ride and you get off, and you may not notice the impact of those so much, other than that one quad's a little tighter or one glute's a little tighter, or you know, you've got a pressure point on your foot. If you're a triathlete, then overworking with one leg or creating some tightness around the knee can have severe repercussions for you when you get off to run in a race, or even if you're training, the impact of that tightness developing through poor saddle fit then being highlighted when you go for your next run, and then feeling your knees sore and then compensating again, that eventually leads to an injury, doesn't it? And I know when they opened the, probably back around the time that you were starting in business with Jebiomized, they opened the High Performance Centre at Bath, which was the first of the high performance triathlon centres in Britain. And the physiotherapist noticed there that that triathletes tended to get injuries that they wouldn't see from either runners or cyclists. And they felt that the tightness was coming from the cycling, but was noticed during running. So, yeah. You know, again, a little thing which you might think, well, it's only a saddle, you know, it doesn't really matter. But actually, the repercussions further down the line can be a lot bigger.
So when we talk about triathletes, I think the saddle is, for me, one of the most important equipment pieces of the overall bike. And it's also, in my opinion, the most underrated piece in the whole industry and in the whole scene. And I will try to explain why. So when we think about our typical age grouper as a client, as a consumer, and they often have the wish to stay in the aero position for as long as possible. And it's often the case when we start a bike fitting project with an age grouper that we have maybe 2 hours of aero position, and then they have to go into the base bar position for maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes just to relax the pressure on the saddle before they can go into the aero position as well. From an aerodynamic standpoint, that's a worth thing to do, to go into the base bar position for quite a long time, because this is the biggest negative effect to your aerodynamics. It just increases your CDA drastically.
Yes.
So when we work with age groupers, we see that the limitation number one is the saddle. If the saddle doesn't fit, it's really hard to rotate your pelvis anterior and to load the front part of the saddle. But for triathletes, it's important to rotate the pelvis anterior. Otherwise, it's really hard to reach the extensions and to be stable in the yarm pads. And I don't speak about an aggressive aero position. I just speak about a normal triathlon position.
Yeah.
It's important that you can rotate your pelvis forward. If the saddle feels super uncomfortable in the front, it blocks you from rotating forward because the front part of the pelvis is the most sensitive part. If you rotate forward and you bring your pubic bone to the saddle, there are a lot of blood vessels, a lot of nerves. If they get pressure, and if they are closed, you naturally rotate the pelvis posterior to reduce pressure over there. Mm-hmm. But rotating posterior in a tri position leads to often issues with the low back, because you have to hyperextend your low back to hold that aero position. And this whole circle often leads into, okay, I have to leave my aero position and go into the base bar position. So I think from a comfort perspective, the saddle is important, but also from an aerodynamic perspective. When we work with our professional athletes, there is often about how do we gain some out of the position? How can we be more aerodynamic? It's not about how can I hold that for 4.5 hours. It's more about how can I be a little bit more aerodynamic. But there, the saddle is also a key factor, because it's the same story. If you can't rotate the pelvis forward, there's no way to go one space lower, for example. There's no way to place your head between the shoulders and to really go into a shrug position. This all starts with the pelvis. So I often say also in our aerodynamic fittings, when we are in the velodrome, if we don't get the saddle right, if we don't create stability on the saddle, we can't do anything with the front end, because it won't be sustainable. It might be for 1 minute in the wind tunnel. It might be for 3 minutes in the velodrome. But you often see the trend at the end of that test after 2.5 minutes. Yeah, there is kind of instability coming in. So I can't expect that this position is sustainable for 4 hours or for 5 hours. Mm. So for me, it always starts with the saddle to get that right. And to get it right means to find the optimal balance between leg clearance, which gives enough space for a straight pedaling, and contact area, which gives enough area to carry your body weight. And this balance is always individual, but it has to be found. If you can't find that balance, I think, it's not the optimal that you can get.
Definitely, I think in the triathlon market, maybe in the age group, in the recreational cycling market as well, that there's got to be something about education here, because I would think that most people will buy a bike from a shop, or these days, you know, if it's a Canyon or a Quintana Roo, they'll have it delivered to the house and they put it together themselves. It comes with a saddle. Often there isn't a choice on saddles. You know, you can choose different bars, you can choose different wheels, you can choose what group set you have. There isn't really, or doesn't seem to be many that offer options on saddles. And then most people just take the saddle they've got and they try to make it more comfortable by lifting it, moving it forward or back, or tilting it, which we've already mentioned. And that's it. And then if you go onto some of the social media places that people inhabit, you see conversations galore about, what do you think about these wheels that I should be changing on my bike? What do you think about me getting a bigger front chainring because it looks more aggressive? What about these bars? I don't think I've ever seen a conversation talking about saddles other than when somebody said, maybe the split nose ones versus the conventional shaped saddles. So there's got, you know, we talked in the pre-chat about education. I think there's a huge market in some way of educating riders on just what you've said about why the saddle is actually the first bit of kit that you should be thinking about when you upgrade your bike or buy your bike in the first place.
Yeah, so I totally agree. And you see a lot of nice graphs about possible aerodynamic gains you can get from wheels, you can get from the frame, you can get from bottle holders or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's often there is a piece of position inside. But for me, the saddle is really an aerodynamic piece. And it's an equipment piece that determines your aerodynamics. And that's something that it's not really told in the market. So not a lot of people speak about that. But we do a lot of these aerodynamic tests. And we often see if we just create stability on the saddle by switching to a different model, by maybe changing the seat height, by reducing a little bit of saddle tilt, that you don't move so much forward with your pelvis, we already see a positive effect to CDA. So we haven't touched anything on the front end. We have just worked around the saddle stability. We can measure objectively there is an increase in saddle stability. And then we see on the track, okay, there is also a positive effect to CDA. CDA is lower than before. And I think that's a story that's still new to tell, but yeah, it's definitely worth to tell it, because we have got two gains here. I talk about aerodynamics, but the bigger gain is comfort, because when we get stability, it's often that you reduce pressure, for example, about 25-30%. When you think about that number and think about all the other fields of optimization, where do you get 25 or 30% of benefit? This is a long way to go. You don't get that with wattage, or you don't get that with CDA normally, but you get that with comfort. And this is a true number out of our averages in the lab. You can normally, if you set up the saddle in the right way by using pressure mapping, it's quite often that you do 25, 30%, not just with age groupers, but also with professional riders. that you can gain these things by adjusting it in a very fine way. So I talk about millimeters when I talk about adjustments here.
Can you talk about the pro riders that you have riding for you? Because you've got quite an impressive resume.
Triathlon or world tour? What do you want to?
I think most triathletes will understand who the top world tour riders are, but we could start with the triathletes.
Yeah, so we have worked and supported over the last years. Jan Frodeno, Patrick Lange, Sebastian Kienle. We've worked with Annie Haug. She is. This was a funny story. We brought out our triathlon saddle in October 2019, and that was the first race was Kona, and the first race of our official race with our saddle was that win in Kona. So that was a pretty cool coincidence. Annie Haug, we've worked with Patrick Nielsen, David McNamee is riding our saddle. We've worked with Alistair Brownlee. So there's quite a long list of triathletes that we were able to support over the last years. And this is always pretty cool when you have this opportunity to work with such a pro and to think about what are the small screws, what are the small things that might result into a benefit.
Yeah, and I guess when we watch coverage of Kona, because that's the one we tend to get the most of, and you see the riders sitting in that aero position for hours on end, we all probably look at it and think, yeah, well, for one, they're pros. Two, they've got a good bike fit. I bet we rarely think about, well, they must have a comfortable saddle. But as you say, it makes sense that that's where it starts, because I can't remember which pro rider it was in the World Tour. Might have been Contador, doing a time trial on a bike and constantly shifting his position on the saddle as if he was...
3.5 seconds from one shift to the other. 3.5 seconds.
Yeah,
3 to 4 seconds.
Constantly moving backwards and forwards. It was so glaringly obvious that either he didn't like that bike setup or he didn't like something, or he, I think it was probably towards the end of the tour, so maybe he did have a saddle sore. But
so we did a real project over the last 5 years concentrating on saddle stability for time trial and triathlon. And the starting point was me sitting in front of a television watching the Tour de France time trial. I think it was 2016, and really counted these saddle shifts. So we call a saddle shift when somebody really moves over the front of the saddle and has to actively reposition the pelvis backwards.
Yeah.
And what's the timeline between one and the other? That's why I know exactly that it's between 3 to 4 seconds with Contador. And our aim is always to, when we objectify these saddle shifts, to try to prolongate the time from one shift to the other. Mm-hmm. Because it makes a big difference. If you do a saddle shift, this pedal stroke is basically lost because you actively use most of your body weight to move backwards, so against the direction you're riding. And this is, it costs a lot of energy, because at the moment when you move over the saddle front, you're basically up in the air. So your pelvis stays for a second without any support of the saddle. That means it's all supported by your core muscles. You have to support, you as a rider have to support your pelvis in that moment, and then you actively move the pelvis backwards. So in a lot of different ways, it's just negative when you have a saddle shift. And that's why we are so obsessed with analyzing these shifts and getting the number down. And this is one factor in our analysis we have used with all of these triathletes to understand the saddle shifts. For example, Zebi Kienle was also a guy who did a lot of saddle shifts in the past. And I can say from my point of view, with the adjustments we have done with him, there was a significant change, and now he's shifting maybe one or two times a minute, so way, way less than he has shifted 3 years ago. So, and you can see that with a lot of different projects, that saddle stability really makes a difference.
With Contador, was that something that was due to discomfort, or is it just a bad habit that he's developed that started with discomfort and he just never sort of managed to change out of?
Yeah, to be honest, I also worked with Alberto 1 year later when he was at Trek Segafredo. And I know a little bit more of the insights, but that's something I don't want to share here. It's just, it goes more into a private medical thing. And I think that doesn't should be here.
Okay, fair enough. Now, in the UK, we have Phil Burt. Phil has been developing his own saddles recently, and he was based at the Cycling Centre in Manchester. Did you have much collaboration or interaction with Phil? I do know that you had this tight little title, which was a little bit of play on the thing that they had at British Cycling, wasn't it? I'll let you tell everybody about that one.
Yeah, so I met Phil first time, I think it was in 2012, so quite a long time ago, at a conference in London. And we exchanged some ideas, and it just took a few weeks until we had some more conversation about a collaboration. And I was in the lucky situation to visit Manchester in 2013, 2014 for some time. So I traveled over there more than once, and we did some pressure mapping days at British Cycling together. Phil and me worked with some athletes, and not just about the saddle, but it was an overall positioning project with analyzing all contact points and really understanding when we do one change, how does maybe reflect on a different contact point. So it was like a holistic approach to understand it. It was always pretty cool to work with Phil. And we did some work together. British Cycling also used our technology, not just with us, but also for their own projects. And since he left over there and he's now being in his own studio, we still have contact from time to time. So he's using our technology. He's analyzing his clients with our saddle pressure mapping. And I think we share a lot of the same philosophies, and the approach in a lot of ways is similar, and also our minds are quite similar. That's why it's always a pleasure to talk with him and to exchange ideas and to look into the future, what could be next.
Anybody that logs into your website will notice that you've got this little group called the Secret Saddle Club. And in British Cycling, Chris Boardman used to have that Secret Squirrel Club, didn't he? Which seems like you've had a little joke on that word.
Yeah, that's a reminiscence. So when we have developed our saddles in 2017, we were looking for a name to just make that intro, to bring it to the market. And we don't wanted to market it just as a GBMI saddle design. And in the first year, we had some pros using our saddle, but unofficially, because they had other saddle sponsors. So it was also always from the starting, like the Secret Saddle, we can talk about, but it's already in the World Tour and also in Pro Triathlon, but unofficially. And that it's as it always is, you sit together with a few people from the company drinking a beer in the sun, and somebody came up with the idea, hey, what about combining the secrets of our saddles with that old Secret Squirrel Club and make it as a Secret Saddle Club? And we liked that idea. And I know how this Secret Squirrel Club, I know a little bit about what they have done. And I think, it fitted well to our saddle concept. And then the whole market reacted in a very positive way, especially our bike fitter network really liked that story of being part of a secret development. And we still use that. And we market our saddle under the Secret Saddle Club brand. And it's still valid because from time to time, there is a saddle that we deliver black and black without any logo. And so it's still like the Secret Saddles are on the way.
Let's say that somebody's listening to this then, Daniel, and hopefully they've sort of a few things have clicked in their head and they thought, yeah, do you know what? Actually, I get all of that. I'm uncomfortable. I shift around a lot. My saddle's tilted down at the front. I need to be GBMized. So what's the process for an athlete? I mean, particularly in the current COVID times when face-to-face contact is difficult and obviously travel is difficult. What would be the normal process and how's that changed? So it's a two-part answer. What would be the normal process and how's that changed in recent months?
Yeah, so there are plenty of options to do. So you can book a fit session and basically a project with us. We have got 6 labs in Germany, so it's possible to just book a session over there and get GBMized in one of our labs. But you could also just search on our website what are partners that are working with our technology, because most of the partners using our technology also got educated by us. We do a lot of education for other bike fitters, so I'm pretty sure there are some good fitters in the UK also using our technology, and they also offer services that are outstanding. But you, as you said, it's totally right. Our service normally depends on a personal base. So I love to be in the fit studio and work with a rider, with a cyclist from face to face. And we do some assessments in the beginning of a fit that you need to get an idea about the flexibility level of a rider, for example. And it's really hard to do that these times. We have closed our own lab since about 2 months now. But we are looking forward to the period when we can reopen. And we have tried to help, especially the clients that we already know, with some fit sessions online. And I also worked with a few pros with fit sessions online, where you try to share the video where I draw some angles in that case, because we don't have a pressure system. But just, it's easier when you have some baseline mappings of these riders, and then you do a follow-up, like helping with new equipment, for example. I've just recently talked with another pro rider who switched teams, and now he's got different saddles, and he has got, of course, different bike and different shoes. And we could make some good progress with 2-3 video sessions. Of course, it's not the same, but I would still say it's better than nothing. It's better than just trying to find the right saddle, and he has got 10 to test at the moment, and better to have a session and to exclude maybe 7, and he has just to try 3 now. So I still see that we can do something, but of course, it's not the same level of being face-to-face and work on a fit studio.
So in normal times, then, if somebody was coming across to Germany, is that a process that could be completed in a day, or would they need to come back again?
Yeah, so we have different kind of services. It starts with a 2.5-3 hour session. And this is definitely something that can be done in a day. Mm-hmm. We also have higher levels of service that goes into 3 or 4 days, not 3 or 4 hours, so this way. But it could also be that we start a long-term project. So for example, if somebody wants to be as aerodynamic as possible on a tri bike, that's often something you can't reach in 3 hours or in 4 hours, not even in a day, because you need some adaptation phases in between. The rider has to do some homework, then you do a follow-up. So that's also something we do, maybe to start a long-term project and to say, over the period of 6 months, for example, we plan on 3-4 milestones where we see us, and there are adaptation phases in the meantime to work on specific things. And at the end, there should be, and hopefully there is, a good gain in terms of aerodynamics and comfort, but that's nothing you can reach overnight.
Right. Okay. Well, definitely we must put those contact details for you and some of your fitters in the UK onto our show notes so that interested listeners can take that step further. It's definitely something I'd be interested in, because some of the things we've discussed about fiddling around on this, you know, fidgeting around on the saddle, and I've not ridden a tri bike for quite a while now, but my new tri bike came in one of those split nose saddles, and it definitely feels too wide and a little bit uncomfortable. So I'm not sure I'd like to do 5.5 hours on one of those, but so we'll definitely put those details in the show notes. Can you talk about some of the subtle differences there? I mean, you've talked about the differences in riding style and saddle fit, but if we were to look at a road saddle versus a triathlon saddle, what are the subtle differences that we would notice?
So when we have started the whole pressure mapping journey with GBOmized around 2001, 2002, it was already in the first study when we have seen that you can classify riders by loading type. And when I speak about loading type, I mean it could be the main pressure on the front. So this is a front loading type. It could be main pressure on the rear. This is a rear loading type. This is the most basic categorization of loading types. But I think it's important if everybody thinks about how do I load my saddle? Do I load more the front or do I load more the back? Of course, when you think about a triathlete, it's very often the case that the front has got more importance than the rear part, just because of the shift of center of gravity more to the front and the extensions and the bars that just keeps you to more on the front. So if you understand that principle, then you have to look at subgroups. For example, what's the main issue somebody has in a tri position with a saddle? And you already mentioned that. If it's too wide, it pushes me forward. So if the saddle design and the front part is not right for your riding style, for your pelvis width, for example, for your leg clearance, then it pushes you forward, and then it's a pretty high chance that you experience these kind of saddle shifts, that your pelvis moves way to the front at the saddle tip. You do one push more, and then you are pushed over the saddle front, and you have to reposition yourself. So the saddle width for triathletes, especially in the front part, is super important. And I know some triathletes, they use a saddle that it's not in the right width, but they do some zip ties below the saddle to just make it more narrow. And that's just a trick. And of course, everybody can do the trick, but it's just because the saddle is not narrow enough. Mm-hmm. So the saddle shape is not narrow. On the other hand, you don't want to override leg clearance, because if you do the saddle as narrow as possible, it doesn't give you stability and it doesn't give you enough contact area. So you have got a negative effect to comfort. Mm-hmm. And so it's a tricky game to find a good balance between the leg clearance and the contact area. And if we shift that topic to road cyclists, for example, there we have a similar topic, but on a different part of the saddle. We're talking more about the mid part of the saddle. Mm. If a road cyclist needs a lot of leg clearance and doesn't suffer so much regarding saddle discomfort, then it's more important to have a saddle shaped like a T, so the letter T that you know, because then you have got quite a narrow mid part and the leg clearance is given. So we don't want that the saddle is too wide, that the knees go out, or that there is a rotation of the pelvis. Mm-hmm. And then we have got another group of road cyclists. And I would say this is maybe the most typical group of road cyclists. I talk about a male cyclist, which is a little bit of limited in terms of hip flexibility. So not as a yoga dancer, that we can classify that. And they are often riding an aggressive position by sitting quite upright with the pelvis in the mid part of the saddle. But if the mid part is not wide enough for both pubic rami, you twist to one side, you load one pubic rami more than the other side, and then you get a lot of negative effects, not just to your pelvis and to your comfort, but also to your knees, because often then one knee kicks in, the other knee kicks out, and you lose performance on the pedal. So for these kind of riders, I would prefer to go to a V shape, a saddle which is a little bit wider in the mid part, that you can place both pubic rami on the saddle, and they offer support for being straight with the knees, for example. So I think it's always the question between leg clearance and contact area, but you have to think about that more discipline specific, or not just discipline, more from a positioning standpoint. Is it a very aggressive position, very aerodynamic? Is it a moderate position? Is it more upright position? And then you get these answers. Do you want to go more into a T or into a V-shaped saddle?
Wow.
And that's why we have designed our whole portfolio around these loading types and around these two shapes, basically.
Wow. It is more complex than I believed. And I guess I'm quite in tune with some of these things, because I have a physiotherapist who does a lot of the stuff that you talk about. You know, she does bike fit, but she spends an hour or two looking at the way somebody moves first before she puts them on the bike. She doesn't just try to fit the aerodynamic bike to the person. So, but still, a lot more than I realized. And what about the difference between male and female saddles then? Because we see male and female saddles marketing, but is there really a difference there?
Yeah, I would say, so if you look at studies with a large population, you see differences between the male pelvis and the female pelvis. From my experience and also from our internal studies, we see that the individual difference is larger than the gender-specific difference. Okay. So you could have a male with a female-shaped pelvis and the other way around. And for us, there's more than just the pelvis, so the anatomy of the pelvis. It's also about the flexibility, for example.
Right.
If you're able to rotate your sacrum forward or not, about your position, about your seat height. So there are a lot of things coming in. So We have developed saddles that work better for women, and we have developed saddles that work better for men, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I don't use the one saddle for the other gender. So we don't market it like a man and a female, a man and a woman saddle, because it's just not true. And if you market it this way, then you would just create a barrier for the rider to say, yeah, but this is a female saddle. Why should it work for me? The female saddle offers the chance to be a little bit more in motion on the saddle. We have shaped our saddle that's we unofficially called female saddle, that it just offers the opportunity to be a little bit more flexible on the saddle, because women in general are more flexible on the saddle.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you want to create more flexibility for a male rider, it's better to go that way. And the other way, if you have a female rider and you want to create stability, maybe because they are too much moving on the saddle, better to go to the saddle model that offers more stability. So I wouldn't go really into a gender way. It's really the individual, and we try to keep that in mind and focus on the individual.
I'm just thinking a way in which the differences between male and female products are marketed, you know, and often you get female saddles, which probably aren't that much different to male saddles, but they're pink. And so, you know,
yeah.
So like, yeah,
that's the worst thing to do. If you also put a color inside, then you really drive to a specific image. And yeah, that's something we don't want. And all bike fitters using our saddles, they really love that opportunity that they have got 8 road saddles that they can choose from. And there is a specific group for each kind of these saddles, but it's not based just on female or male. There's more behind that whole riding concept and loading type concept to look at.
Hmm. We talked about saddle tilt earlier. I get frustrated when I see a triathlon bike where they've got quite a lot of seat post extension, almost as if it looks more aggressive and therefore it's better. But then the saddle's tilted forward at 30 degrees, quite clearly because the rider can't ride the bike with the saddle that high. And I always think, well, you know, that's just going to slide you forward. So you're going to put so much pressure on your arms and your shoulders that you're not going to be able to maintain that position for very long anyway. Why not just get a proper bike fit? But you've seen a lot of triathletes, Daniel. What are some of the biggest errors you see in the way they set up their saddles and the way they set up their bikes?
So saddle tilt is definitely on my top 3 list.
Oh, good.
And exactly how you explain it, I've seen a lot of triathletes that are coming into our lab with maybe 7, 6, 8, 9, whatever degrees of saddle tilt. And it often results into an unstable position of the pelvis. The pelvis moves forward just because you can't keep it that way because it's so tilted. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's the first sign when I measure the bike and I see that there is a significant saddle tilt, that something's not right with the saddle height. Because it's often a compensation from the rider when the seat height is not correct. Mm-hmm. When you're sitting too high, you often experience in the aero position, you experience pressure in the front part, in the sensitive front part of the pelvis. So the easiest way to try to get rid of this is to take your screwdriver or your Allen key and to tilt it down. Mm. And then it's not enough. You tilt it down more and more, and then you end up with more than 5 degrees and you feel like you're moving forward and you create more pressure to the hands or to the elbows or to the upper arms. And then you have just shifted the problems to a different part of the bike or of your position. And my trick is often to reduce seat height and to increase the saddle, so to reduce saddle tilt, but to do that at the same time. If you just do one, you don't get a positive feedback. But if you reduce seat height and then bring the saddle into a more neutral position, that really helps for saddle stability. For comfort, you have to find that balance. Maybe, so if somebody comes with an aggressive tilt, like 5 degrees or more, I wouldn't go to 0 in one step because I think that's just too much and they have to adapt that. But I would try to go to maybe 3 or 2.5 degrees. And to keep that in mind for another readjustment, maybe 3-4 weeks afterwards, to go into the more neutral position. And from my experience, if we are talking about a saddle tilt from 0 to -3, that's something I could accept as a fitter. If it's more than that, and there is no real medical reason for that, I would definitely try to change that by work on the position.
All right. So you said,
do you want to know the other
yeah,
two on the
I do want to know the other two. Yes, please.
Yeah. So the number one is for me wrong saddle height. That's something I very often experience in the fit studio, and that has a lot of negative aspects, not just to your saddle comfort, but also to your power transfer to the pedal. I hope I explained that before already. That and saddle height, to getting that right, it's really about millimeters. It's not that there is a 1 centimeter difference. That's often not a problem. But when somebody comes from this angle-driven approach, we could say, okay, a knee angle is totally fine. Ankling is also fine.
So I'm just thinking there, as you say, in millimeters, if a triathlete was riding their time trial bike, their race bike, wearing conventional cycling shorts, and they've got padding in there, and then on race day, they're wearing tri shorts, which are generally got minimal padding, that's going to have a few millimeters of difference. And so that's going to have an impact on saddle height. So how would you suggest that they set up their saddle then if they're doing most of their riding with normal bib shorts with bigger chamois? Or would you advise that they don't ride with those?
It's not just the seat height. It's also the saddle comfort, because your normal bib short has often a better damping than your race suit. Right. And keep that in mind. I have worked with triathletes and they said, I feel okay in all my long rides, but when every race day, I have a problem after 1 hour. And when you compare that, you see this thin chamois, and in their bib shorts, they maybe ride with a chamois which is three times high and gets a complete different damping. Okay. So my suggestion is often, or all of the time, bring both into the fit studio and let's pressure map your training equipment, and let's pressure map your race equipment. And this might lead to two different seat heights that we say, if you go to race day and you do your pre-race ride, for example, in your race closing, before that, so 3 days before the race, adjust your seat height accordingly, or maybe also adjust the saddle tilt accordingly. So it could be that it's a different saddle position for the race than for the normal training, just because you're using different equipment between training and race. And we always try to optimize then both scenarios, that you get the best for both situations.
Okay. All right, so that's two. Saddle tilt, saddle height. What's the third one then?
It's really saddle shape and finding the right saddle model that fits for me and for my pelvis anatomy and for my riding style. And this is something, there are so many saddles on the market, so many different opportunities. And I think it's still, there's a missing guideline to understand how can I find my right saddle? And I hope in that hour now I could explain a little bit why it's not just about, okay, this saddle has got a 154 width and my pelvis should fit into that. It's way more about where do you load the saddle? Because a lot of producers say, we measure your sit bone distance and this sit bone distance has to fit into our saddle range. Yeah. But if you're really sitting anterior rotated with your pelvis and you're loading the mid part to the front, then it's not about your sit bone distance, because your sit bones are in the air. They don't have even contact to the saddle. So the sit bone distance is not important. So to understand really the realistic loading and try to transfer that into the right saddle shape and find the right saddle shape. So this is error number three that I see in our labs, because it's just not so easy for a normal cyclist to find the perfect one.
Wow, I've learned a lot today. Now I'm going to pay more. I'm going to pay a lot more attention to my saddle going forward.
Yeah, it's as I said, for me, it's a very important contact point, and not just because I've worked on that contact point for more than 15 years now. You can really gain a lot of benefits when you concentrate on that saddle and when you give it a try by testing it out. Hmm.
We talked about earlier that you know there's really only three contact points, and you did mention that you have the pressure insoles that you can put into bike shoes. Have you gone further than that with any of your product range and started thinking about designing shoes or pedals, or maybe even, because you've not talked about whether you have any pressure sensors for the handlebars yet, and yet I guess poor saddle position can impact how much pressure you're resting on. Now, I know that after some rides, I feel like definitely the palms of my hands get a little bit more sore when I've been doing certain rides. So that might indicate that there's a bit too much pressure on the bars and maybe my saddle needs adjusting.
Yeah, we have used our technology for different developments and for different studies in the past and also nowadays. So for example, we can transfer the dynamic pressure plot in the shoes into custom insoles. And that's something that we do just different than others. Our philosophy is to analyze in the dynamic way because that's the most realistic way. So if we want to make an insole, we have to understand how the foot stands and how the foot moves in the shoe. And that might be different to standing because it's just a complete different position. You're clicked in with the front part, your cleat is at a specific point, then you're pushing down the pedal in every pedal stroke. And so the pressure mapping result is a base to make a custom insole. That's a transfer into a product. We've also developed some grips, some MTB grips in the past by using our pressure mapping technology to really understand how you load the specific grips and how you load the bar and how we can optimize that. I remember a discussion with a journalist here in Germany about 10 years ago about how can we test different bar tapes and maybe get more damping properties for a road cyclist on the bar. So we've also worked a little bit on these aerodynamic bars with, for example, with Scott as a industry partner to find a good balance. Of course, they care about aerodynamics because they want to make an aero bar, but they also care that it doesn't have a negative impact to comfort. So can we create a larger contact area and still be aero from a perspective of the bar? So we can help with that by using our technology and creating these pressure plots and analyzing a group of people to really say, yeah, this bar works better than the other bar. And I think it's still a way to go. So these are the first steps in different products where companies also understand that our technology and our expertise can help. And I think this will be even more in the future. I do feel that the days are behind us where a lot of bike dealers are just looking at me and saying, why do you have a laptop at a bicycle fair? That doesn't make sense. I think the whole world has changed in that matter.
Mm. Yeah, well, I'd agree. And I mean, if I've been listening properly and picked up what you said, Daniel, the takeaway points for me are this. The saddle is the most important part, and that's the bit we should be starting with. We shouldn't be thinking about it afterwards or when it gets sore and just replacing it. We need to think about that before we start thinking about saddle height, and we need to think about that before we start thinking about which are the best wheels and the best bars for us, because the impact of those will be lessened if we haven't got our riding position correctly. So it all starts with the saddle is the basic message.
I completely agree with that. And I think that's a message to really bring out to the cyclists. If they get a better feeling about the importance of the saddle and if they control themselves in the next ride, if the saddle feels okay, and if the saddle doesn't feel okay, where does it hurt? Is it the front? Is it the back? Is it a compensation to the legs, for example? Is it the left foot that makes a problem that maybe also has the cause given by the wrong saddle? And then I think it's good to get in touch with a professional bike fitter. First of all, to tell these problems and to see if he or she has got an idea or a solution where to go. Sometimes it's just complex. You experience problems at a contact point, but the reason for that is at a different contact point. And you have to think about the whole position, the interaction between rider and bike as a complete package. It's holistic.
Daniel, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been enlightening and it's been great to chat with you. I hadn't realized that there was so much in this, but clearly I've been missing out on some stuff for the last 30 years.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was super fast, 1 hour. So it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Make sure that we get your all of the links that we need for resources, please. And we'll put those in the show notes for you. So if there's anything you've got coming out soon, if there's anything you want to tell our listeners and our other readers about, then we can put that in the show notes and make sure that they get to see those. I was going to, you showed right at the beginning, you held up one of your saddles. So listeners won't be able to see this little bit. For those people, I'll maybe share this little bit of the video. What did you have there?
So you mean this one?
Yeah.
It's always a road saddle.
Yeah,
it's a sleek 145. This is our road saddle in the flat design, which really increases the stability of the pelvis.
Okay.
And this is shaped in the V, so you can see it's for riders who want to get some contact area in here, mm-hmm. and who are sitting more here in the front and a little bit in here, so they don't have an issue with leg clearance, but get the positive benefit by the larger contact area in here.
Brilliant.
And you can just bring that saddle out as a one model, because then you lose the whole group of people who really sit more to the back but needs leg clearance in here. So that's why we think about these two complete different roads.
Okay. Well, I guess you'll have somewhere on your website where people can view the different saddles. So we'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. Yeah.
We also explain on our website the difference between V and T shape, and why it's important to understand about your loading type, about your comfort level, and these kind of information to find the right one. Yeah.
Perfect. All right, Daniel, thanks so much for being on the show. I really appreciated it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a good day.
Thank you to Daniel for joining me on the High Performance Human podcast. You can find links to just about everything we chatted about in the show notes. Also, a reminder that if you are interested in being part of my SWAT Inner Circle, you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. Please email beth@thetriathloncoach.com or look for a link in the show notes. All right, that's it for this week, and I'll be back next week with another great guest. But for now, stay healthy and stay focused on being a high-performance human in every aspect of your life.